This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning.
I decided to give this talk, this particular theme, and it's about leaving home. We're having the ceremony we sometimes call Chukai, but it's also called Zaike Tokudo, which is often translated as something like staying home and accomplishing the way. And I'll talk about another way of interpreting what it means. This morning, I and several of us who have heard some news, I'm thinking about one monk at Tassajara who left on a hike last Monday, told people where she was going, took some snacks and some water, and didn't come back. And her body was found yesterday. She seems to have fallen off a trail. It's very well known to everybody at Tassajara, the horse pasture trail, if you've ever been there, and was found at the base of a waterfall. And so obviously this is very upsetting news, but I also thought how every day we leave home in the belief that we're going to come back, we leave dishes in the sink and tell our cats or dogs or kids or partners, see you at dinner or whatever. And every day people do not return home. So here it is, right in front of us, birth and death. And I don't mean this to be a big downer, because we have a really wonderful ceremony coming. But it's sometimes said, practice as if your hair is on fire. So don't forget, birth and death are the great matter. So leaving home, in the way that Buddhism talks about it, right? It's renunciation. The strong recommendation that, you know, if you really want to achieve awakening, if you want liberation, the royal road to that is to leave home, to take monastic vows, and to assume the form of a monk, shaved head and robes. Now, here I'm wearing this, and I am not really practicing as a monk. I am a householder as well as a priest. So that's the first thing I want to say. But this is the best way, it's usually said, to single-mindedly and wholeheartedly practice without the distractions of everyday life with others in the world, with family, and a conventional kind of living. And, you know, a home leaver, I think our archetype is still a person who is male, although that's not true. Not all home leavers are male, but it's kind of an archetype. Buddha was the archetype, home leaver. And this person, male or female or something else, has left the householder life, is celibate, classically, relies on donated food, owns a bare minimum of things, and has no fixed place to live, and little personal space or time. Somebody once asked Suzuki Roshi, what should I do with my spare time? And he just laughed and laughed and laughed, as if we have anything like spare time. In some traditions of Buddhism, monks may wander part of the year and practice with various teachers or by themselves. And so not even a single monastery is our home. And I think those of us who have even tasted this life briefly have found ourselves often at different monasteries, experiencing different teachings and styles of practice. And in Japanese, novice monks are called unsui, cloud and water, drifting and flowing according to conditions. So as I said, the Buddha is an archetype of a home leaver, the prince who had it all and walked away from a palace, a kingdom, his family, including his young son, his wife, and all pleasures and privileges, to seek the truth about existence. This is a very difficult path to follow, and one that relatively few of us take up as a lifetime commitment. Now, the admonition to leave it all behind may elicit strong and complex feelings among many of us in our place and time. On the one hand, abandoning one's family and skipping out on one's responsibilities is not really virtuous behavior to us, right? Many people come to me and say, how could the Buddha have left his son and his wife and his parents and his responsibilities? Is that really upright behavior? It's a good question to hold. But on the other hand, we are daily confronted with home leaving. We do it. Many people do it every day. And then, of course, in this time and in all times, there is forced home leaving. Especially now, tides of refugees all over the world leaving behind some, at least, of their family, searching for safety, searching for home. So, you know, voluntarily leaving home and family seems cruel. How can something so extreme as leaving one's spouse and children, something so apparently uncompassionate, be the path of liberation? And we may reasonably ask if it is really necessary to do so in order to practice and to actualize the teachings and the reality that the teachings point to. Or we can think, well, maybe leaving home is a metaphor. That feels a little better. You know, it's an exhortation to some ideal that we can decide for ourselves to either ignore or to kind of reformulate for the 21st century lives we live. Or maybe it's discouraging. You know, is this just an aspiration that's completely out of reach of most of us? Is liberation and awakening out of reach for those of us who have responsibilities? I don't think so. And I think we can be encouraged by the fact that the Buddha himself said that he would not pass from this life until the fourfold Sangha was established in wisdom, in skill of meditation, and in confidence. They were really grounded in the teachings. The fourfold Sangha is lay women and lay men, householders, female monks and male monks. And all four were necessary in his understanding his understanding of Sangha, at least after he had admitted women as monks. That didn't happen right away, as many of you know. So the Buddha acknowledged all of us as capable of training and awakening and included all of us. So what about tokudo? So we have two kinds of tokudo. There's shuke tokudo, which we sometimes just gloss as priest ordination. That's what we say, shuke tokudo. Shuke is actually two words. It's a compound. Shutsu is going out, leaving, and ke is house or home, right? And this is usually translated then, shuke tokudo, as leaving home and accomplishing the way, right? But actually, toku means to attain or realize or comprehend, and the do is not way. It's not the same do as the one that is related to dao, right? The dao of Taoism. It means something like limit or boundary. So the compound tokudo is better understood as to accomplish crossing over the boundary. So leaving home and accomplishing crossing over. And we also have the ceremony and opportunity of staying home, literally staying home and crossing over. And that's the ceremony we're going to be doing this afternoon. And this ceremony formally is called zaike tokudo. Sometimes it's called lay ordination, but it means lay crossing over or staying home, zaike and tokudo, crossing over. So I think we kind of have this idea that tokudo means ordination and one is lay ordination and the other is priest ordination, but that's not exactly what it means. both forms of ordination, or I won't say ordination. That's a habit now for after 20 years, but I'm going to call it, what am I going to call it? Receiving the precepts, that's what I'll call it. Both involve receiving the precepts, both priest tokudo and lay tokudo, right? And these are the expressions of ethical speech, thought, and action that are central to Zen practice and actually are central to Buddhism, the ethical precepts. Now we get to be the confusing part. Buddha said, fourfold Sangha, this is my vision of Sangha. But he also said, home leaving and precepts must go together. And he said that although one can stay home and observe the precepts, that leaving home and taking the precepts is superior. It's better. And he even says, it's better to take the form of a monk and break the precepts than to stay home and observe them. So it sort of feels like this is definitely a hierarchy, right, of tokudo. And I'll come back to this divide a little bit later. So the ceremonies for priest and lay precepts are very much the same, right? One receives Buddha's robe. For lay persons, it's the blue rakusu, which you can look around the room and see this thing that looks like a bib. In our lineage, it's blue. And priests wear a black one, and they also sew a wrap robe, like the one I'm wearing and other people in this room today are wearing also. And the rakusu is just a scaled-down version of the larger robe. They have the same construction. Ananda and the Buddha ordained this structure of how to make this, what it should look like. Right? So in that sense, we share the same clothing, and we refer to the rakusu as a rakusu, but also as Buddha's robe. And this is a kesa, but it's also Buddha's robe. So we all wear Buddha's robe, whether we're priests or lay people. And in our lineage, we sew Buddha's robe ourselves. And people come in and they've never even threaded a needle, and at the end of a year, they have sewn this robe themselves with guidance. So we all sew Buddha's robe ourselves, and our teacher, who offers us the precepts as part of the ceremony, in addition to the robe, offers us a new name and lineage papers, a kind of family tree, which is called the Ketchum Yaku, or blood vein, right? A living descent from the Buddha through all of the generations of ancestors in India, China, Japan, and now in the West. And it's in this ceremony that we vow to live by the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. We all do. And we ask for support in keeping these vows from the Sangha and from all Buddhas and ancestors. So that's this afternoon. But you might wonder, well, if we all are receiving the same precepts and we're getting Buddha's robe and the lineage papers, what is the distinction between zaike and shuke, staying and leaving? Well, as I've already said, there is a monastic path of home leaving. But lay people also, at least in our time and place, also often spend weeks, months, or years in monasteries, subject to the same very rigorous daily schedule, doing whatever is assigned. No free time or privacy. And I highly encourage any of you who are able to undertake it, even for a short time, to do so, despite all the obstacles, and not the least of which is there's some cost involved. This training is essential and usually expected of priests, because priests are expected to be trained in the ceremonies and the wearing of this form. But priests and non-priests alike practice the same practice otherwise. They all sit zazen together, they eat together, and take the same vows. So in our time and place, priests who have received this training also usually have to secure a living. They have to worry about shelter and food and have loving family and friends. And so a constant koan for priests is, what is this leaving home that we have undertaken when we also stay put while embodying this outward form? So it's a kind of koan or practice question that we keep looking at. So I want to turn to what Dogen had to say about home leaving. Dogen is the 13th century of our common era. He's the 13th century founder of our Zen school in Japan. And as it happens, he wrote about home leaving quite a bit. He spoke of it in Bendo Wa, which is his earliest writing on practice, and in two chapters in the Shobogenzo, which is his collected essays. One of the Shobogenzo chapters is called Shuke, just home leaving. And the other is called Chuke Kodoku, the virtue of home leaving. And Chuke Kodoku, he wrote towards the end of his life. So he had a lot of time to explore this topic. And in that chapter, he begins by talking about the difference between lay and home leaving practice. And he quotes our Indian ancestor Nagarjuna, who said, "Liberation is difficult for lay people because if they attend to their daily affairs, their practice declines. And if they attend to practice, their daily affairs do not prosper." Does this sound familiar? Now, Nagarjuna lived in the second century, and he says about this question, "Without choosing one and abandoning the other, lay people need to practice Dharma. This is difficult." He does not say impossible. But then he goes on for many pages to extol and elevate leaving home for both men and women. And it's difficult, you know, to read some of these teachings again, I think, without feeling some discomfort, because again, it's stated very clearly at many points that home leaving is far better than lay practice. Right? Not merely that it's more difficult. This is Dogen's view. But Nagarjuna also maintains that it is better for a home leaver to break the precepts than to practice virtually as a layperson. So that also seems like a pretty strong judgment, right? Better for a home leaver to break the precepts than to stay home. And for us stay-at-home types, it's hard not to take offense or to lose hope. Dogen said, "Not even one of the Buddhas of the past, present, and future in the 10 directions became a Buddha as a householder." Thanks a lot, Dogen. "Because there were Buddhas in the past, there is leaving the household and receiving precepts," he says. "The attainment of the way by sentient beings invariably depends on their leaving the household and receiving the precepts. Because leaving the household and receiving the precepts is the definitive way of all Buddhas, the merit is immeasurable." And then Dogen gives lots of examples of lay people who have accomplished great understanding but did not leave home, but he still maintained this view. And in another essay related called Jukai, Receiving the Precepts, he says, "All Buddhas in the three temporal worlds, past, present, and future, affirm that to leave home life behind is to realize the truth. The 28 Indian ancestors and the 6 Chinese ancestors, all of whom transmitted the Buddha's mind seal, were each and every one of them monastics." And he goes on and on, right? He says, "Had they not distanced themselves from their faults and guarded against misdeeds, how could they have realized Buddhahood and become ancestors?" So we keep kind of like wavering back and forth. Is it okay? You know, can we stay at home and still realize the way? Well, right. There's this very strong impetus from some of our teachers to do the opposite. So I want to here introduce Brad Warner, a Zen teacher, a contemporary Zen teacher, a little bit of a renegade, but I think he has a good point of view on these apparent contradictions. He says that in these writings that I've just been quoting, Dogen's writings, he says, "Dogen is like an AA sponsor, talking to someone that she's sponsoring and trying to instill confidence in the 12-step program." So in Warner's view, the monks at remote, cold, and rigorous monasteries like Aheji or Tassajara needed to be inspired to follow this difficult life. In his view, then, it's not that you can't get sober without AA or that the 12 steps guarantee that you'll get and stay sober. That's Brad Warner. And also we know that later in his life, Dogen emphasized the monastic path when he had to withdraw into the mountains and establish this training monastery after many vicissitudes and moving around for a number of years. And that earlier he had seemed more open to an embracing of lay practice, recommending Zazen for everyone, but later in his life, he thought, we really need to kind of, you know, concentrate. So Dogen is like an AA sponsor, right? Get on the path, that's the best way, right? Kind of selling it. According to Dogen, the Buddha also said, addressing his followers, this is a paraphrase of Buddha, he says, "You, home leavers, should not arouse an unwholesome mind. If you do, you are not home leavers." So he's chastising the home leavers, saying, you're not really home leavers if you don't have the mind of home leaving. He says, your action and speech should be in accord with each other. If they aren't, you are not home leavers. Then he says, I abandon my parents, siblings, family members, relatives, and teachers to leave the household and practice the way. Indeed, this is the time to assemble wholesome awakening. It is not the time to assemble unwholesome awakening. So he's admonishing monks who have given up everything. He says, wholesome awakening is to have a kinder heart towards all sentient beings, as if they were babies. Unwholesome awakening is not like this. And this reminds me of the three minds, which he talks about in his instructions to the temple cook. Right? The temple cook is supposed to have joyful mind, magnanimous mind, and parental mind. So I think Buddha is here talking about Robashin, literally the mind of an old woman, the mind of a grandmother, grandmotherly mind, seeing all sentient beings as little children, as babies who need care, tender care. That's how you should practice. And toward the end of that particular fascicle, Dogen says, you have not only received a human body, which is rare to achieve, but you also have encountered Buddha Dharma, which is rarer to encounter. Quickly abandon all relations, leave the household and practice the way. He says, you can always encounter kings, ministers, and family members. On the other hand, Buddha Dharma is as difficult to encounter as an Udumbara blossom, which is one that, I forget how what's the periodicity, but once every 1,000 years?
3,000 years.
How many?
3,000.
3,000, thank you. Or 1,000 or 10,000. You get the point. It's a long time. When impermanence arrives with no time, I didn't write this, remember. I didn't choose this theme before after I heard this news that I related to you. When impermanence arrives with no time, none of the kings, ministers, intimate friends, servants, family members, or rare treasures can help you. You go to the yellow springs by yourself. The only things that accompany you are wholesome and unwholesome karma. And the yellow springs is the realm of the dead. So this wholesome mind, wholesome awakening, is what is of concern to Dogen. In Zui Monkey, a collection of his informal talks, he says, lay women might attain the way as a result of practicing the Buddha Dharma as they are, as lay people. However, no monk or nun attains it unless he or she has the mind of one who has left home. So here he's saying, again, if you leave home and don't have this way of wholesome awakening, you are wasting your time. It's not some magic ticket. Dogen says, this is not because the Buddha Dharma discriminates between one person and another, but rather because the person doesn't enter the Dharma. There must be a difference in the attitude of lay people and those who have left home. A layman who has the mind of a monk or nun who has left home, that is, you know, free of attachments, even though they're still with their families, such a person will be released from suffering, from samsara. A monk or a nun who has the mind of a lay person, that is, they think only about wealth or career or status, they have double faults. their attitude should be quite different. It is not that it is difficult to do, but to do it completely is difficult. The practice of being released from samsara and attaining the way seems to be sought by everyone, but those who accomplish it are few. Life and death is the great matter. Impermanence is swift. Do not let your mind slacken. If you abandon the world, you should abandon it completely. The names provisionally used to distinguish monks and nuns from lay people are not at all important. So that's where he comes down in the end. To make a distinction between the everyday and practice is a mistaken view. For Dogen, and I think for me, and this accords with the Zen understanding that practice and zazen and our everyday ordinary activity are not limited. They're not limited, zazen is not limited to the cushion. It's definitely not limited to the monastery. And Dogen also remarks on this often and in the context of leaving home. And as I said before, he wrote these two essays about home leaving, right? Shuke meaning one who has left home. And he praises receiving the precepts as a monk, and he says, quite starkly, someone who has not left home is never a Buddha ancestor, right? I already said this. But he also says, remember in truth, in case you think you're doing something really great by leaving home, remember in truth that the day of leaving home is beyond unity and difference. And he also says, the day of leaving home has transcended already the day of leaving home. And though this may be so, when nets and cages are broken open, svaha! When nets and cages are broken open, the day of leaving home is just the day of leaving home, and the day of realizing the truth is just the day of realizing truth. Ordinary. Here it seems to me that Dogen is emphasizing the non-duality of leaving home. There isn't really something called leaving or not leaving home. And at the end of the fascicle in which I'm quoting, he says that to leave home is to practice for the liberation of others. And he says, any place where we see, hear, and learn in practice the Dharma preaching that in my youth I left family life, we meet the Buddhist state of unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. How important is the virtue of leaving home? It's as important as your head. So, to sum up, I think we can draw several conclusions from these writings and stories about the home leaver life and the stay-at-home life. Dogen, following the example of the Buddha himself, promotes leaving home, taking the precepts, and taking up the form of a Buddha as the most efficacious way to actualize Buddha ourselves. But to take the form and to take the precepts without the mind of practicing for the sake of others, for all beings, is not to be a true home leaver. If we include everything in our practice, we truly realize that there is no place, no one, no thing that isn't practice. And then we have left the idea of home as a particular place. We have left behind our idea that this is me and this is mine, my family, my home, my concerns, my affairs. Dogen was wise enough to understand that substituting other affairs for home and family and so on, like my practice, my zazen, my seat in the zendo, my rakusu, my tokudo, my enlightenment, just keeps us in samsara. Crossing over isn't going anywhere. It's expanding our life and our responsibility beyond what we are strongly and karmically oriented to regarding as ours. The teacher Cohen Franz says, to accept who you are, to accept your status in the world, is to accept that you have a responsibility, one that is too big for there ever to be a way out. There is no other side. Crossing over to what? Right? There is no other side. There is no point at which you have paid your debts. There is no moment at which you are permitted to backslide, to admit to being an adult, to admit to being Buddha, is to agree what has always been your situation. It's okay. I won't fight this. Are there any comments, questions? Are you thoroughly confused? Objections?
Oh, that's not an objection.
Okay. You can object.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about using the everyday situations to wake up.
How is it for you?
Well, you put me on the spot. Sometimes it happens naturally, and then sometimes I totally forget about it. I'm just in my life doing it. And so then when I come back to the teachings, it reminds my body what I'm doing. So then there's more chance for it to happen naturally. So it's kind of a coming and going situation.
So when your body doesn't know what it's doing, why is that, do you think?
I think part of it is because I'm on autopilot and I'm in a habit, and probably also in worry about the future or fretting about the past.
Yeah. So renunciation can be just dropping all of that. That's a kind of form of renunciation. I've realized as I've gotten older and forgetful, more forgetful, that if I walk into the room with these, my glasses, and put them down while I'm thinking about something else, I have no idea where these are. I just had them. And I go around and I say to my husband, "Bunkai, where are my glasses?" Sometimes they're in my head, but often I just put them down in some place and I was not there. Right? I put them down, but while I was putting them down, my mind was in the past, the future, or furiously thinking about something. So those can be little wake-up calls too. Oh, I wasn't there. So a lot of our training where we say, and you've all heard me say it a million times, like, carry something with two hands, even if you can carry it with one hand, you know, really kind of keeps you more connected with this thing and respects it also. You give it your full attention, no matter how small and insignificant it is. And you're more likely to just be there with it and for it and not to see it as a separate phenomenon from yourself. You include it, you know. So any moment is an opportunity to wake up.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, sir.
Thanks for this talk. Just really touched a tender part for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking, like, sometimes, not all the time, awakening is hard. It hurts sometimes.
Mm.
And I wonder if you could just speak to that, or what we do.
I like to quote Suzuki Roshi on this. He famously said, people were, you know, saying, "Well, how come you haven't enlightened me yet?" and things like that. Right? He once said, "You might not like it." Without making any claims to being awake, fully awake myself, I will say that as I started to open up to things that I previously held at arm's length, various forms of suffering, my own and the world's, I went to my teacher, "What do I do with this? I feel more open and it's very painful." And she said, "Sit some more. Keep sitting." So we learn to accept that too, right? Maybe this isn't what I thought it was going to be. I'm going to go through that gate of enlightenment and everything is going to be okay. it's all going to be bliss. I'm going to be blissed out.
Probably not.
You know, I read all of these Rinzai books that were out in the 80s about people's amazing enlightenment stories, right? You know, like they'd be sitting in sesshin and like, boom, right? And it was all lotus blossoms and joy, and they just, you know, they smiled for 3 days, and they went in to see the teacher, and the teacher said, yes, you know, this is it. Right? That's what I wanted. Like, and I said, Zen can get me there quickly? Great, sign me up. I don't have to wait lifetimes for this. It's not been my experience. There's a lot of nods in the room right now. Yeah. Not to say that it doesn't happen, you know? I mean, I don't think people wouldn't record these experiences if something didn't happen. But the other thing that my first teacher once said to me, I had some experience that I thought was like a big deal, and I told her, and she was not very impressed, it seemed to me. She didn't quite say, that's nice, but it was, you know, she took it in, and she didn't like confirm, you know, or she just was very, very still with it. And a couple of weeks later, I came back in and I said, is enlightenment impermanent just like everything else? And she like got right in my face and said, of course! It's like, damn. Which means to say, you know, you have these experiences and they feel like progress, right? And they can encourage us. You know, you are a little more awake, you don't feel separate. You have that mind of regarding all beings as tender babies, and you love everyone and everything, and then poof, right? So you just stay on the path. Yes?
Thank you for the talk today. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how teachers will, in one moment, talk about how awakening is right here, right now, the only place it could be, but also, it can never happen in a million years, and it's the rarest thing ever. Any thoughts on that?
Buddhism is full of holding two things, you know, that seem to be totally contradictory at the same time. Like, you know, there's non-duality, there's the, you know, sometimes called the absolute, and then there's all these things, the 10,000 things. And there's this line from one of our teachings, you know, just say when doubt arises, not to. Right? Not two, but it doesn't say one. Right? We talk about oneness, but it's like not two-ness and not oneness. This is the middle way, right? So it's both. And I've heard other people say, you know, that liberation is being able to go to swing back and forth. You're with the 10,000 things, and they each have their suchness. But you're coming from a place of awakening, hopefully. Awakening is influencing your understanding of the 10,000 things.
Thank you.
Jenny?
Thank you for your talk. I felt tender and also just so appreciative. And I was thinking about, this is a little different, but I'm like right on the eve of a really huge professional decision to leave a career that I've had for 14 years, and it's what I need to do. And I've been in the process of discernment for this for like about 4 years. And so I was thinking of that idea that, like, I can't remember what you said, but once you get to that place of change, it's like another, it's just another day, I think, when you make it. And so in some ways, it's almost like a letdown because it's like I've done this whole process and now it's like, okay, well, you know, bye. Kind of anticlimactic. So I'm kind of wondering, like, how in the midst of that do you still honor that, because it feels like a home leaving in a lot of ways for me, and I don't know what's next. And so, you know, whether it's like ritual or something else, I wonder, like, you know, is this a thing, and how do you sort of still mark it while saying it's just another day?
It's one of those both and situations, I think. Yeah, it's just another day, but you can, you know, you can honor your process and then let go. You know, I also gave up a career, a long-term career, and I kind of knew it would be like this, but then I really experienced it. It's like a hole in the ocean. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like people go on. You think you're indispensable, or you think that this life you've been living is indispensable to who you are, and you're not sure you're going to survive. That not knowing is the place to be. You know, true intimacy is not knowing. It's not knowing boundaries. It's not knowing who you are. You know, on this fundamental level, it's not your job. That's not who you are. And I knew that, but it's like when I turned in my keys, you know, and took my name off the mailbox and all of that, it was like, whoa. And then yet the next day, somebody else had those keys and there was a new name on the mailbox and it's gone. It's, you know, I mean, I remember it. It comes back and I'm still in touch with people from those years. It's a lifetime. It's part of me. It's not separate from me, but it's no longer me. And actually, the first time I explored this topic was about 5 years ago when I was also contemplating leaving Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where I had been practicing for 20 years. That seemed really big. And then in the end, it was like, road trip! We drove to Texas. I had my lucky kitty on the on my dashboard, waving goodbye to all the states. I was actually asleep when we crossed from Arkansas into Texas. Bunkai, my husband, woke me up and said, "We're in Texas!" And then we had pandemic right away. I was like, oh, I came here to practice with the Austin Zen Center, and now I'm in isolation with everybody else. You know, that was not knowing. That was like, okay, this is what we've got. Mm-hmm. All of us.
I'm glad I'm in the not knowing part of that. I'm where I need to be.
Yeah. Not knowing is most intimate. It's a big teaching.
There's someone online.
Oh, thank you. Bruce?
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Good to see you.
Very, very good timing as well. I think many people there, or at least a couple people there, will appreciate that the subject of home leaving is close to my heart, and homecoming as well. I left Austin a year and a half ago to go to a place that, in large part, my move was motivated by a desire to return home, or a homecoming of sorts. And so the concept of, or the question of what is home, what does it mean to leave home, what does it mean to come home, has been very meaningful for me. And I think it's possible to see it both, it's possible to see home as a sense of familiarity in a place that you're reluctant to leave. But in some sense, it can also be a place, a destination, or a place that you belong. When we talk about refuge and what is home, at some level, if not a refuge. I don't have any wisdom on the subject. I just wanted to throw out there that there's even more nuance than one talk or one conversation has room to hold. So I think a number of times I've been motivated by this inexplicable desire, and I think that's really what I have to offer on this, is that I don't know that anyone can know, even for themselves, much less for another person, when it's time to leave, when it's time to go. And I think that the perhaps the best a person can do is try to discern and know, well, this is as good a time as any, or this is the time for this particular move. I think there was one ancient teacher that put it most concisely in the form of a question: should I stay or should I go?
And now I'm going to have that little ditty in my head.
If you go, there won't be trouble. I stay, it would be double. I don't know which way it is, because, you know, it might be different. Your mileage may vary.
Your mileage may vary. So, thank you, Bruce. For those of you who don't know, Bruce was a resident here for 5 years, and the Eno, long-term Eno, very strong, dedicated, stable practitioner, and he left to go home to Missouri. Bought a sweet little house and has been sending pictures on Facebook of the daffodils coming up this spring. And mm-hmm. and all the other things that, and speaking of not knowing, is now employed in a job he never thought he'd have, kind of making that adjustment. So yeah, and you know, the other thing is, the not knowing is, you know, you set out on a hike and you think you'll be home for dinner. So it was the time to set out on a hike. It was a day off, I'm assuming. You know, and you get to go on hikes, and we're asked to tell someone where we're going. So we have an idea, people have an idea, you know, of where you might be and when to expect you. You know, all those good practices, right? It's the big buddy system at a place like Tassajara. And, yeah, we don't know. So it might be the right time. I mean, we could have had a car wreck on the way to Texas, right? Mm-hmm. That would have been the end of that. So we set an intention, and then something happens. So don't attach too much to results is another fundamental teaching. Right? Set your intention. Don't attach to results. I think Mary has her hand up. I think you're muted. There we go.
Thank you for your talk. It was wonderful. It was a wonderful teaching. Thank you so much. I wanted to say, for those of us who've done military service, there's a lot of home leaving and homecoming and home leaving and homecoming. So I don't know where that fits into the idea of being a monastic, but you have to take a sense of home is wherever I am. So leaving physical home is never really, it's not leaving home, because you have to instill a sense of home in yourself, because you have, because somebody's always telling you where to go, when to go, when to come, and how long to stay. And so just giving a shout out for those of us who've been in the military service, we came across the practice, and the practice has helped sustain us through the life of having someone tell you when you go home and when you leave. So thank you.
Thank you for that. There are at least a couple of veterans in the room right now that I know of. The monastic life is a little kind of like the military, right? You know, you wear certain things, you all eat together, you accept the work that's assigned. Sometimes you get promoted, and sometimes you get busted in rank. And it might be like, oh, yeah, actually we really need you to go now from Green Gulch to Tassajara, or Tassajara to the city. I don't wanna. Please go. Yeah. But it doesn't have the purpose of the military, which is, so it makes it, hopefully, you know, the mind of wholesome awakening as opposed to unwholesome awakening is what is driving all of that in a monastic situation. Kenkai?
Yes, thank you for your beautiful talk. I think this concept of home really evokes a lot for many of us. And, you know, for those of us who grew up in difficult homes, the idea of leaving home is really enticing. I know when I heard that concept, I was like, yes, more with this leaving home business. And then what I found was, you know, because we practice in Sangha, actually, as soon as I got to the Zendo, home was reconstituted, right, with the relationships that I had with my Sangha members. And I think in Dogen's Fascicle that you quoted from, he says something like, true home leavers are monks who don't engage in discord and friction with each other. So like for me, paradoxically, the leaving home has been about staying. Like, mm-hmm. being in this relational field that we're always in. So thank you for touching on that.
Yes, that's a whole nother, not another topic, but a theme also that, you know, like wherever you go, there you are, right? You take it all with you. We're always looking for a fresh start. But in the end, we have to sit down with ourselves, you know, to sit down with ourselves and look at our own patterns and reactivity and suffering and everybody else's, which all show up too, right? Which is why it's helpful to face the wall and not talk. We do a lot of that. But yes, staying with the practice and staying with Sangha, it's a triple treasure. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, can't have one anyone without the others. Even when we're sitting by ourselves, we're still sitting with all beings. Thank you.